Hey folks, Damian Mason coming at you. Before we hop into another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture, I want to tell you about Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag is a company that has pioneered predictive soil analytics. You know, we always treated diseases and pests after they were already in the field, when they were already causing us a problem. But what if you can do this proactively through predictive soil analytics? Pattern has a technology that through their technology, you can say, oh, here's the likelihood that I'm going to have soybean cyst nematode. Here is the prediction on how bad of a risk I face for sudden death syndrome or corn rootworm and a whole bunch of other diseases and pests. When you know what your risk factor is, you can more efficiently and proactively treat for the disease. You can do this by going to pattern.ag and figuring out what your risk factors are through predictive analytics. That's right. Go to www.pattern.ag and then get a hold of your Pattern Ag representative to help you do predictive analytics on your farming operation. Well, greetings and welcome to another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. It's me, Damian Mason. You knew that. It said so in the introduction. Got a great program for you today because we're talking about connecting customers to markets, a behind-the-scenes look at commodity markets. I'm going to confess to you right now, and you've probably heard me if you listen to any of my 270-plus episodes, anytime we talk about commodities, markets, marketplace, yes, I know the price of soybeans, roughly. Yes, I know the price of wheat, roughly. But you know what? I'm not a markets guy. I have a degree in agricultural economics, but guess what? I don't deal in this world. But you do, because if you're in the business of agriculture, everything that we produce generally is sold on a market, and it's also a global marketplace. And there are people that all they do is analyze this. Frankly, that's what they're good at. And I've got two of those guys on here right now, Dave Smolt and Kyle Schrod. They're with StoneX Financial, a division of StoneX. I'm going to be speaking to some of their customers in February in Las Vegas. And I said, you know what? Why don't you come on and tell my listeners about what's happening behind the scenes? We see it. We hear it every 30 minutes you're driving down the road. If you're listening to AM talk radio, ag radio, like some of us still do because we remember it as kids, and they come on to tell you about the markets. And sometimes you're like, I don't really know what that means. But you know what? You don't need to be embarrassed. I don't really know what it means either. And I have a degree in agricultural economics. So guess what? Join me on this journey as we're going to learn about the markets. We're going to find out what the hell's happening. And we're going to talk about the future. We're also going to talk about what StoneX does. And that's where I'm going to lead off. Dave, what does StoneX do? Why do I need you?
Well, Damian, good to be on. And like you mentioned, we connect customers to markets. And in particular, Kyle and I spend a lot of time with the commercial hedgers, and that's, you know, customers all the way from farmers to elevators to manufacturers, processors, just up the food chain. Spend a lot of time in the ag and energy food markets. And what we do is we provide customized risk management solutions for those customers. We're working on their side to give them insight, give them recommendations that will take away risk and hopefully, you know, improve profitability.
All right. That's a neat answer, Kyle. That sounds like what you would say if you were giving a talk at the Rotary and you hope that maybe somebody at the local Rotary was going to become a customer. What's all that mean? Why do I need you? Okay, let's just say this. I'm one of the people that's going to be in our audience February 28th. I'm going to be, I own a company that processes cheese. We're not one of the big, huge, we're not Kraft. We are located in three states. Why do I need you to be a better cheese processor and marketer of my own cheese to the consumer?
Well, ultimately, the biggest thing that we're doing for the processors is we're helping them serve their customer, right? So we're working with the processor to allow them to be able to set a fixed forward contract for their end customer that they're going to be working with. So we look at ourselves as a value add, you know, not only for the processor, but to help them add value to their final end customer as well.
All right. When I get looking at the markets here, Mr. Dave, I say, all right, I don't fully understand all this. Who does this stuff? So I get it. Even if I listen to the markets report and they're like, okay, fluid milk is this, feeder cattle are that, whatever. Bring that home to me. Am I buying this stuff? Do I need you to help me buy and sell this stuff? That's where I always get a little confused. Like, who's doing what? And what's your role?
And again, that's part of our role is we'll provide the clearing and execution. So when you go trade a futures contract or options contract on an exchange, you've got to have a IB or an FCM, and we're an FCM. So we're able to provide that clearing and execution of those trades that you're using to hedge a product. All of our customers we work with are dealing in the physical product. So they're, you know, growing something, manufacturing something, and they have a risk that we can then hedge with a derivative. And that's, I think, one of our key pieces is we have a platform of the exchange products, futures and options, but we also offer over-the-counter, which can be customizable and flexible, provide a bear solution, and we even use physical market. So it's really using all the different tools available to minimize the risk and improve the profitability.
You use what market, you said, besides, okay, we got futures, I got OTC, and then what?
So physical market. So we can provide, we can actually buy that physical grain and embed some optionality into it and make that sale for them. We'll stand in between the two parties. So it's not using a futures contract or an OTC, it's using a physical contract. And that helps provide some financing in those terms. We basically sleeve that financial piece for the customer and just stand in between as a middleman.
Okay, so let's go back to the customers. Give me an illustration. Kyle, tell me, just give me a profile of one of your customers, especially like one of the ones that's going to be at this meeting that we're doing in Las Vegas.
Sure. So the simplest way, and this is kind of embarrassing, right? But I always like to tell stories. I think I'm a little bit like you, Damien, where I like to keep things entertaining, right?
Stories. The Bible is the number one book in the world because it's stories, right? Humans, our brains are programmed to understand stories.
I don't know if I've told Dave this story or if he's heard me tell this story, but when I was younger, I moved down to Chicago and I was working as part of our grains team and I became part of our dairy team. And, you know, my in-laws would always ask, like, what do you do? What do you do? You know, and you're like, man, how do I explain this to the layman's, right? Like, how do I make this make sense? So we're down in Mexico and my wife and I had been together for quite a while. So our family's really digging and trying to get a sense for like what it really is that I do. So a couple of, daiquiris at the pool and we head into town to do a little bit of shopping and entertaining. And so I started kind of trying to explain this, right? I'm like, okay, so you guys know like the McDonald's cheeseburger, right? And they put the McDonald's cheeseburger on the dollar menu. Well, and they do all this planning and, you know, there's advertising and marketing, and then there's printing all the ad boards and everything else, right? So McDonald's puts this whole program together and then suddenly the price of cheese goes from $1 to $2. Yeah. And now the cost of producing that cheeseburger just went from 90 cents to $1.09. And they can no longer put that dollar cheeseburger on the dollar menu without taking a loss. Right. And so you kind of tell that story. And what we would really do with them is, you know, hey, listen, you have a part of your business that you want to plan out over the medium to long term. So how do we go out? How do we protect the price of cheese or the ingredients, the meat, the wheat that goes into the bun, all of those things in order to guarantee that you have a fixed price that you can then advertise and do long-term planning and promotion for your ultimate end customer.
Yeah, that's a very good parable, anecdote, story. And I want to go with that and take it to the next level. Let's say that McDonald's example, they're going to do the dollar cheeseburger and they want to make sure that they're under a buck. And we always know what loss leaders and all this kind of stuff, but let's say they wanted to build it in. So they're at least using that to get customers in the door, but they still don't want to lose their ass on it, right? They still want to make like 20 cents a cheeseburger. How long out are we talking about? Do they come to you today and say, we want to do this this cheeseburger special? Our marketing department has it ready. We're blasting it out on January 1st or February 1st or whatever that day should be. And then you've got a week to go ahead and get them their cheeseburger, their cheese, their beef, their inputs priced.
Yeah, it varies by customer. It varies by commodity, to be honest with you, right? Some have a shorter term time frame that we go out and trade, right? Dairy trades 2 years into the future. If you look at like energy or natural gas, you know, I think you can go up to 10 years into the future. So it kind of depends. And, you know, I think the one thing that we always find, and I'm sure Dave, you had backed this up as well, is like we get called, we get the questions when people feel pain. Right. So a lot of times people go through that experience one time of, oh no, you know, I had a cheeseburger and I had this promotion all planned out and suddenly the market moved against me and we weren't ready for it. We didn't know what to do. Right. And then they'll come to us and go, hey, can you fix this? And it's like, well, not in this instance, because it's a little bit too late. Right. The market's already made its move. But what we can do is we can start planning this stuff out forward and we can start making these longer term decisions based upon where the markets are at and how we might want to trade them and how that can impact your business from a longer term perspective.
That, by the way, does a really good job, Dave, of simplifying to the person that's just driving down the street that buys cheeseburgers the whole thing. But there's a lot of stuff, a lot of complexity that happens in the behind the scenes stuff. That's what you do. Is it that easy? Do I just come to you, Dave, and I say, hey, I want to do a cheeseburger special. I'm in charge of McDonald's promotions and here, take care of it. Or is there a lot more that I'm not thinking about?
You know, and it starts with just opening an account and getting that done. And that's become a much bigger process because of regulations than it was, you know, way back when I started. But now once you're a customer, we want it to be a very collaborative effort. You know, we feel like we're working with that customer. We want to get to know their operations. You know, what grain elevator is a good example. You know, do they do rail? Do they do truck? How much storage do they have? How much are they going to take in and harvest? How many trains do they have to get out? So it's, you know, knowing what's going on in their operation that helps us better understand what they're doing. So yeah, we'll take and do as much as they want us to do. We customize it to the, you know, to that account, that customer. But at the same time, we want them knowing all the way along why we're doing the things we're doing, how we came to that conclusion. You know, we want them to know what got us to that point of that recommendation.
All right, so let's answer the question. Then you use the example of a fast food restaurant being one of your customers. Then on the other side of that, there's people that make the cheese, and they're your customers. And then there's the companies that so you're kind of on both sides of this. Wait a minute. If I go and hire an attorney, I can't have an attorney representing me that also is representing the person I'm suing. How the hell are you on all sides of this? Explain that to me.
I think that's one of our biggest benefits, right? Ultimately, because, you know, we talk about education, and then I think our other role is really filtering market information, right? So the more people that we're talking to from farm.
Wait a minute. That means I tell you, hey, I'm going to have a glut of milk. I'm going to make as much cheese as possible. You run over after I talk to you behind my back and you tell McDonald's, hey, there's going to be a whole bunch of cheese coming on. I got it from the inside over here. You know what we should do? Plant a big, huge cheese, double cheeseburger thing, blast it out, make a whole bunch of money by buying cheap cheese. Is that what I'm hearing?
If only it were that simple, right? You know, because ultimately, especially in dairy and you know, kind of having a grains background myself and then moving over to dairy is really unique because it's something that we produce every single day, right? So the grain markets, you know, we see heightened volatility throughout the summer months when that crop is in the ground, right? So we have maybe 4 to 5 months of really heightened volatility within grain because we only get one shot at supply.
Right.
Whereas in dairy, we're making that product every single day. So, you know, something like that, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? But ultimately, you know, we're paid when you trade, when you transact, or we're paid for the education process. So, you know, if I put myself in the shoes of say a competitor who's only working with restaurants, you know, the only way to get paid would be to tell the restaurant to buy, right? Because unless they transact, I'm not receiving any revenue, right? But if I'm working with a producer, and you know, it's a bad time for the restaurant to buy, but it's a good time for the producer to sell, and I have a balanced book, now I can really, you know, sit there with clarity and say, hey, I'm not only focused on the sell side, right? And there will be times in the markets where it's a good time to sell. There will be times in the markets where it's a good time to buy. And I think when you're working with somebody who has a nice balanced book like that, doesn't feel any pressure to push somebody to buy when the market's at its highs.
Dave, we've used a bunch of examples here from restaurants to cheese processors to cheese producers, what have you. My point is, when the average person thinks about the ag commodity markets, they think the people that use them, that have to interact with them or be dictated pricing and selling prices by that, are farmers. And what I'm hearing here is you got a whole boatload of people that are your customers that aren't farmers.
Yeah, but it all starts with the farmer. You know, it goes back.
Well, that's where the production happens. But in terms of your book of clients, we always think, okay, the farmer needs to know about how to sell May bean, or you know, May corn or something like that, old corn for March delivery and all that kind of stuff. But that's not necessarily who all your customers are.
No, it goes right up the food chain. Like I said, we start with the farmer to the elevators that store it. To the companies that process it, to the companies that then use that raw, you know, beans are always a good example. You're going to go process those into, you know, meal and bean oil. And okay, who's buying bean oil? All kinds of food companies buy bean oil. So we're working with each one of those levels of customers. And you know, back to your point, it's, yeah, that does give us a perspective of what's going on. Now everything's, you know, confidential with every customer. So we're never giving away trade secrets or what their positions are, but it gives us a view of, okay, we know what's happening in Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, as there's a drought passing through those three states. And how's that going to affect overall production? And
I want to talk about the mix. I want to talk about the mix of your customers in a minute. But before I do, there's an old joke. I guess maybe it'd be inappropriate now. They used to say, "How do you turn an Italian guy into a mute? You put his hands in handcuffs because he can't talk with his hands." If you're listening to this podcast and you keep hearing a noise, I've instructed our friend Dave to stop banging on stuff. He's like apparently that jokey Italian that just flings his hands about in any direction, and he keeps banging into his mic. So if you're hearing a noise, it's our friend that has restless hand syndrome. Okay.
I've sat on him, so I don't know what I'm doing now, Damien.
That's all right. Okay, let me ask you this. Percentage of your customers, farmers, how many percentage of your customers are farmers?
I would say it's a relatively new area for us, but within the industry, we're an FCM, and we have introducing brokers that clear through us, and we have introducing brokers that do a lot of farmer business. So,
okay, now wait, you just did that thing. Wait, you just did that thing. You used vernacular that is completely understandable to you. And I think to a lot of people that are even in the industry, there's the guy that's right now driving across Nebraska who's in the herbicide business. There's the woman that's in the crop insurance business in Florida. And she says, what's an FCM and what's an introducing broker? So go ahead, Dave, you take that one.
So if they've got a broker locally that they work with, you know, if they work with Damien and he's got his own company, he's most likely an introducing broker. He's got to go to someone that is an FCM like Stonex is, and there's other FCMs, to clear those trades. And so a lot of the brokers in the country that are just one or two man shops are probably introducing brokers. But going back to the question, we're probably about 10-15% of our customer base is the farmer crowd. It's growing, and that's just on our side. You bring in the IBs, we work with those smaller companies that utilize our clearing and execution services, that number goes up percentage-wise.
Then food processors, that's how much, Kyle, is that?
So our dairy business is pretty well balanced, I would say. We're probably like, 30-30-10 or 30-30-30-10. So producer, processor, end user, and then traders.
Mm-hmm. And then... So, like you talked about grain elevators, Dave. I take my grain to an elevator, and maybe I already have it all brokered and sold and all that, or maybe I don't. Then they also are doing a similar thing, right? And they use your services.
Right. And a good example there though is as a farmer, and I grew up on a farm, my dad still farms. What are you trying to do? You're trying to establish the highest price you can, the highest flat price, so that you can, take and beat your break-even costs. So it's really focusing on when you get to a price level that works for your operation. An elevator is strictly trading basis. They don't care if they buy corn at $2 or $10, they're going to hedge it and they're going to trade the difference in price. Basis is a pretty, for farmers in the grain world, when you say basis, pretty much knows what you're talking about. But so they're not focused on the same goal that a farmer is, where the farmer is trying to maximize the price he gets for that commodity. They're trying to maximize where they sell that basis at.
Yeah. And for the person that's listening, that's not taking AggieCon 320 at Purdue University with Professor Joe Yule, horrendously boring, which is why I absolutely rebelled against this. Horrendously boring. Two people, I bump into people and they're like, oh, you went to Purdue. Do you know Professor so-and-so? I'm like, I don't want to say, you love this guy. I'm telling you, two of the most horrifically boring classes I've ever had to sit through in my life, a guy named Taylor and a guy named Yule. Sorry. It's the reality. Anyway, basis defined in one sentence for the person that's like, hey man, I'm an ag and I've always wondered, I always hear about basis. Kyle, basis in one sentence.
Difference between the board price and your local price.
There you go. Difference between the Chicago Board of Trade or the CME group as it is now and what you can buy it or sell it for locally. Okay. I want to talk about some of the other things about commodity markets. Before I do that, I want to remind you, dear listener, that you can check out all of our cool stuff. Damian Mason channel on YouTube, Damian Mason channel, Business of Agriculture on Acres TV. And I also want to remind you this. If you are looking for information, you probably are spending a lot of time unnecessarily. For God's sakes, if you're in farming in particular, do not go to Ag Twitter, because I see people do this. And then they get harangued because they get all sorts of ridicule that somehow you're stupid. You want information? Because I'm told that 19% of a farmer's time is spent trying to allocate answers to questions. Why don't you shorten time and distance and use your phone? This smartphone right here that I have in my hand, it's smart because it can do cool things like give you the AgVisor Pro app. Go to your app store, type in AgVisor Pro. My buddy Rob Syke, entrepreneur, ag guy, smart dude from Alberta, founded multiple companies. His latest one's called AgVisor Pro. Put it on your phone and find the information you need. You also can become an expert yourself and put up your own profile on AgVisor Pro. Check it out. It will save you time and therefore make you money. And probably save you some embarrassment also. Oh, like what kind of an idiot wouldn't know that? Well, anyway, I'm not afraid to admit that I'm an idiot. Here's what I don't know. Are these times as really tumultuous as we are being told? And I want both of you to give me your perspective on this. Because it seems like if you're a student of the game and you watch and observe like I do, oh, one word defines the way 2022 is. It was tumultuous. It was volatile. And the thing is, I've heard this damn story again, again, again. Stock market. Oh, the one thing I can tell you about stock markets, you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. Well, that's every market. Is it really this tumultuous? Was 2022 any different than 2021, 2017? Give it to me. Is it really that big of a deal, or is this just hype to make sure that people keep tuning in?
Yes and no.
All right, you go first, right? Kyle.
So, I'll jump in first. So, yes, it is. It is more volatile. We do see more price movement. I think that is kind of a long-term trend, regardless of the market that you're in. I think that's part of globalization that's occurred, right? So we were talking a little bit earlier about the radio, right? You're driving around, and I remember back in the days where I'd be, you know, a little kid running around the shop, and you'd hear corn was up 3 cents, and you're like, whoa, 3 cents? What in the world happened today, right? And now we walk in the morning, and corn might be up 10 or down 10, and what happened? Nothing. Right. So it's a little bit a reality of higher prices. Right. So you have higher prices, therefore 10 cent move is a smaller percentage move. But I think it's also a reality of information. Right. Information makes its way around faster. And we're a lot more global than we were 10 years ago than we were 20 years ago when I started. Right. So it's that information flow. And I think it's the globalization of that information flow that has made things maybe a little bit more volatile from a market's perspective. And obviously higher prices just leads to larger day-to-day price moves.
Okay, Dave, is it really unprecedented? Are we really seeing that big of a swing? Now, I think that from a top to bottom in many of our commodities, let's just use corn, for example, I think there was maybe a $2 or $1.50 swing, and $1.50 on $6.50 is what, a 20% move. That is pretty substantial. Is this normal?
I was going to say, we've definitely seen it before. You know, there's always periods of times, usually they're weather production-induced rallies in the market. And this one started out that way with production worries, started out with demand. And that's kind of the one thing I see differently, is this seems to have more legs to it. It's going to last maybe a little longer than we're used to. I think we'll go into 2023. Q1, Q2 was still this volatility because we don't know what South America's crop is yet.
And then we never have. Now, here's the thing. Let's be honest. Yeah. You need customers. Hey, you need customers to need you. And for customers to need you, they need to be scared. You can just admit it now, Dave. You just try to put this fear out there to scare the bejesus out of the markets, at the customers. And they say, you know what? We're going to be your shelter in the storm. You better just go ahead and give your money to StoneX and let's be your advisor, because it's unprecedented, it's unheralded, it's historic. Is that real? Come on.
I was going to say, I tend to be a perpetual bear in a market. So for me to say that, it's just something I haven't seen. I haven't seen as many external factors in the marketplace. You know, Russia, Ukraine is probably the biggest one that tell me when that's going to end, and I'll tell you, okay, that's going to let some pressure off the market. So even if we get big yields, big production, both South America and U.S., we'll go down, no doubt. But we may not go down as much as we normally would, or what we've seen historically, just because we've got the overhang of the Ukraine-Russia scenario there. So just a lot of things in play, and then you throw in the interest rate that we've seen and what that's done to, you know, prices of commodities in general. So,
and I do like to throw in to Kyle's point that
I was gonna say, you mind if I jump in, Damien? Because I think it's really interesting, right? Because we deal with a lot of different commodities and we talk about a lot of different markets, right? And and to be honest with you, dairy is a very niche market. It's very small. It's very unique. But I think, you know, the easy thing for me to say is the onset of COVID, because that's frankly kind of what it was. But when you think about the onset of COVID and you think about the processing of milk, I mean, milk can't sit in a grain bin for 6 months, right? Milk's got to be sold to a processor. It's got to be moved today so that we can make room for the milk that's coming again tomorrow. And so, you know, I think what I've seen in dairy, it kind of applies to what we're seeing even today still in the grain side of things and in a lot of other commodities, I think, because you had a government-supported industry throughout most of 2020. And so we went from a record low price on block cheese to a record high price on block cheese all within 2020, right? Mm-hmm. Just the immediate massive swings, the back and forth, the amount of volatility that we saw. Now, it has slowed down a little bit, right? But ultimately, when you look at the price of cheese, a $2 cheese price is still extremely high from a historical perspective. Right. And I think being downstream a little bit too kind of gives me a different perspective on things, because it's, you know, you look at what goes into a dairy farmer's break even cost, and it's a lot of things, right? But it ultimately goes all the way back to the stuff that Dave was talking about earlier. What's the break even cost for the grain farmer? Right. What's the break even cost for the guy who's producing fertilizer? What's the break even cost for pulling crude oil or natural gas out of the ground today in order to produce these products that we ultimately have to feed downstream? And so, you know, I think that's where this move, this feels a lot different to me, because I think in the past, a lot of those things were driven by an individual weather event, right? Corn prices rallied sharply because the weather changed dramatically. And that did eventually have a spill on impact to dairy. But if I look back over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, you know, energy prices rallied immediately, right? Fertilizer prices went up, grain prices went right along, and so did the downstream stuff, right? So did beef, so did dairy products, the retail products that feed corn, that feed these inputs. Everything moved up together, right? So it's from that perspective, at least in, you know, like I said, my 15, 20 years of doing this, that feels very different than anything that I've seen in the past, because it went through everything, right? It wasn't one commodity and one weather issue and one location. This was everybody went up and everybody stayed up. And I think that's where, you know, from our perspective, I think that's where you look longer term and go, yeah, we probably eventually will correct to the downside, but this is a longer term issue that we haven't experienced in the past.
Dave, our man Kyle keeps talking about dairy, and that's the group that we'll be talking to in Vegas, and that's where he, you know, that's his sandbox is dairy. We don't see, maybe we do. You know, we talked about a 20-25% move in, say, corn prices, and of course, to Kyle's point, $1.50 sounds like a big, huge number, and it is. But if it's only 20 or 22% at prevailing price, if we'd have seen back in 1993, $2 becomes $2.40, that's 20% up on corn. So it's kind of like the numbers get bigger, percentages remain the same. Do we see that in dairy? Like, are 20% moves kind of where we're going to be now? Just maybe that's like the new normal.
Yeah, for as long as we're in these upper ranges. So we're trading probably in the upper 30% of the trading ranges, the historical trading ranges on a lot of commodities, you know, the ags, the meats, the energies. And so you tend to get the bigger moves. Just like you said, your percentages are, you know, 25% at these levels is a lot larger range. We always think, okay, we're going to stay here. We're never going to go back down. Somehow we always go back down. You know, production catches up and we have, you know, both in South America, North America, big production years, and all of a sudden we've got a couple of years where prices are just back down, you know, under $3 to $4 corn, and just, you know, languishing there, and we think we're never going up again. Then we hit the cycle again, and there you go. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, these bigger ranges, these bigger moves, will again probably stay with us as long as we're trading in the upper 30% of the ranges, like we are right now. You get back down to the middle and lower, you start to tame those ranges down, those price moves, less volatility.
I want to talk about something that's impacting all of the corporate world in the last several years, the ESG, environmental, social, and governance. And frankly, I see it, and I'm more in line with Elon Musk, who said this is essentially just social credits, you know, and in China, there's a big social credit scoring system. And if you somehow are a bad little China resident, you know, your money is taken from you. You don't have access to your own bank accounts, et cetera, et cetera. And I think most people should be very weary, very concerned, almost on beware of this whole goodness and altruism packaged as environmental, social, and governance. But then you look at what matters, the markets. Do they give a damn about all this? Is it just the purity of economics when it comes to markets? Or is this whole social awareness and social credit worthiness? And is this, where's the, give me a read. Does it matter?
You need to jump in on that one, Dave?
Yes, I want you, Kyle. You're younger than us. You're younger than us. You're probably still, believe in the altruism of corporate mission statements.
You got to remember, I grew up on a farm just like you guys did. So it's, I certainly have my own opinions, but I'll try to give you kind of the.
Can we say that you have a bullshit meter? Can I say it's a bullshit meter? Okay.
So, I think from a dairy perspective, this is a really, really interesting question again, right? Because it's ultimately when you talk about ESG, people love to talk about cow farts, right? It's like the biggest thing that's out there right now. And I think one of the things that is, potentially holding dairy prices higher and keeping them from moving substantially lower is what we're seeing in the ESG movement from Europe. They are essentially limiting the number of cows that we can have. Me personally, I think it's backwards, right? Because if we have more efficient animals, we've reduced our cow numbers over the years because we've gotten more efficient at producing milk. But now we want to limit cow numbers because those cows that we have are inefficient and are harming the environment.
Now they're not inefficient, but they are allegedly producing methane. But yes, and by the way, that's a very good valid point. The average person carrying a sign out in front of whatever grocery store that dairy is bad for the environment. We have 9 million milking cows roughly in the United States of America right now. That's like half of what it was just 40 years ago when I was a kid growing up at a dairy farm, and we still make more milk, less cows because we're just so damn good at it. And so therefore, if you've got half the number of cows, the amount of methane, the cows didn't become four times bigger.
Less. Yeah, exactly. So, there's that part of it that I guess I really struggle with personally because of where I grew up and my understanding of agriculture and how that kind of production ag and the consolidation works. But, I think the tricky part is, and we've seen a little bit of this change over the course of the last 2 years. And I think it's still something that we're trying to get a read on, quite honestly, right? Is we have these very high prices. We have what look to be extremely profitable margins right now for dairy producers around the globe. But what we're not seeing is the expected reaction in terms of increasing cow numbers and increasing milk production as a result of those strong economic factors. And maybe it's because it's the new kid on the block, but ESG is the first thing that kind of pops into your mind because you go, well, we're not adding cows because we're trying to limit cow numbers. So even if it is profitable from an economic standpoint for these producers, is it ESG that's holding them back? Or maybe it is something else, right? Because
well, it could be cost of entry. It could be cost absolutely. Of entry. It's a tremendously capital intensive business. I'm a dairy farm kid. I rent my farm ground to a dairyman. It's a tremendously capital intensive business. It's not as though you can hop into it. I can hop into making yarn crafts and selling them on Etsy by going and buying some crap at Michael's craft store, right? I can't hop into dairy production at any substantial level without years of planning and et cetera. So there's that part of it. I won't go to Dave. Do the markets care? Is the ESG thing actually limiting, to Kyle's point, the amount of milk that's on the global market? Is it this whole corporate now becomes wokeness, becomes political crusades? Is it really going to change the production of other stuff? What about soybeans? What about cotton? What about anything?
If the row crop production is a great place to look at. Now there's all these companies that will help the farmers generate a carbon credit. They can get paid, $10, $20 minimum per ton. I know of 15 different companies that they could sign up with and, boom, I'll get my 20 bucks and maybe some more. The interesting part is it's just, changing some of their practices, cover crop, no-till, fertilizer rates, just, you know, doing some of those, implementing some of those. But again, what I find somewhat strange is you have a lot of farmers who have been doing those things all along. Cover crop, maybe not. Minimum till, that's been going on for 20, 30 years, you know.
Yeah, so, certain practices have been being done by those that care about their ground and whatnot for a long time that now we're being called more environmentally compliant or environmentally conscious.
Yeah, so I think you know, you're not going to slow down production of a lot of commodities. Some of the practices will allow carbon credits to be generated, which I think as you move up the chain and you get into the corporate companies, that they are, you know, wanting to show the world that their consumers that, hey, we are ESG compliant. We are doing our part.
Well, by the way, ESG compliant is kind of an interesting thing because it's not like there's an actual rule. It's more just whatever you decide it is, right? It's not like, hey, Damian Mason, I'm ESG compliant. Well, what's that mean? Well, I don't know, but I just said I am. So therefore I am.
And we've had a social and governance, you know, policies in place for years. That's nothing new. It's just all of a sudden it's become kind of the buzzword for the industry. And, you know, you throw in the environmental in, which is still, like you said, voluntary. And there isn't a set guideline. It's just best practices according to who. So,
well, that's the good part is that it's just completely it's marketing, frankly. But OK, Kyle, our man, Dave, there just mentioned carbon. I've been, in fact, a sponsor of my podcast is coming on board here in 2023 is a carbon. It's part of that whole thing, helping farmers get payments for carbon. It's still an unclear, murky marketplace. When we have this conversation 1, 2, and 3 years from now, are you going to tell me, hey, you know what StoneX does? We trade carbon and it's just like wheat. Is that what's going to happen? Is it going to be like buying a ton of copper?
I think we will get to that point. Yeah.
And Damian, the amazing part is you can do that right now. So there are carbon futures, emission futures on multiple exchanges. You can take delivery, but it's that physical space you talked about that is very murky. You know, what are the guidelines to be an actual carbon credit, a good carbon credit?
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, Dave, I think if I would become a bigger customer of StoneX. If you could sell my promise to not emit cow farts, I don't have cows, but if you could sell my promise to not emit cow farts, I mean, then we'd both be very happy. Hey, question for you. Speaking about what you do. Okay. I can log on right now. And I can set up an online trading account. You know, the Charles Schwabs of the world really pioneered this. And now technology is so prevalent. I can go on my phone, just like I can go on and get me an AgVisor Pro app and get questions answered. I can go on there and make trades. We've democratized the stock market, if you will, because you used to have to pay some person, fancy person in suit, in a bunch of money to even have access to buy and sell. We've democratized that. Travel agencies have in large part gone away because of all the travel sites. Is this what happens to your business? Do I need you 5 years from now? Is it the same thing? Do I need, because it's a bit more complex. The commodity markets is a tremendous amount of complexity. You're not talking about just buying or selling an airline ticket to go to Jamaica. You're talking about something that's got 3, 6, 9 month horizons and all that. So I can see the complexity of it, but I can also see where it has the same ability to be replaced or downsized. What do you think happens to your industry, your business, 1, 3, and 5 years from now?
You know, technology has really made us more efficient. You go back and you could, we had the electronic trading back in early 90s, it came out. So it's not, you know, when people talk about, oh, you'll go electronic, everything's on a trading platform, that's where it is right now. But our business has actually grown. We've had, you know, we don't spend time taking all orders all day on the phone, passing them off to the floor that's, you know, in a pit in Chicago. So it's become much more efficient markets. And what we do for our customers is we specialize in the market. So Kyle's group, they know everything about the dairy market. If you want to talk to somebody on soybean oil, you're going to go talk to another broker. If you want to talk to someone about the meats, you're going to talk to another team. And so they know those markets inside and out, and that's where we can provide that in-depth knowledge. And then going back to, you know, where we work with a customer, we want to know about their operation. What are their goals? What are they trying to do? When do they need the market? So it's, you know, giving them a much more customized solution and recommendation. So I don't think our businesses change. We just, technology just plays a bigger part in making it much more efficient in that execution of the trades or of the solution we're trying to do.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was going to say, is that you didn't get replaced. You might have gotten where you can do more because of the technology, but it didn't replace you. Is there a threat of replacement? I think maybe the complexity prevents that.
I think so. The complexity prevents it. You know, there's a lot of talk about AI, but it still is not going to know everything you need to know about that operation and their need, you know, what they're trying to focus on.
Kyle, we covered a lot of ground here, and I'm going to be in front of your people soon. What did we not cover that those people at our February conference need to hear about? And what did we not cover that the people listening that have no intention of coming to our February conference need to hear? What thing did we not discuss? We talk about connecting customers to markets and all the behind the scenes stuff. And you can use a dairy example if you will.
I think we pretty well covered most of it. You know, I think this is a kind of a broad based overview of what we do. And really our intention for February is to give you guys a very tight, very specific look into these individual commodities, right? So whether you're focused on grains, wheat, you know, soybeans, corn, or focused on dairy, cheese, nonfat, you know, the intention for our markets outlook is to really give you an intense view at those individual commodities and connect you with, you know, as Dave said, the expert from each one of those commodities, right? It's not me getting up there and telling you what's going to happen with 26 different commodities. It's the guys who know those industries inside and out.
And even then, let's face it, you're not really going to tell me what's going to happen, because then I'm going to hold you accountable. And then when I lose all my shorts, I'm going to call you up and say, what the hell did you do this to me for? Anyway, so, hey, his name is Kyle Schrod. The other guy's name is Dave Smolt. They are both with StoneX Financial, and they are a client of mine. I'm going to be in February, I think it's the February 28th, in Las Vegas, speaking to your clients and the people that you serve. I will not be on stage talking about my prowess and expertise as a commodity markets guru, because as I've already stated, that's not my thing. I will be talking about marketplace. As I always say, I'm a marketplace guy. We'll be talking about the Asians of agriculture, all these things that are impacting our industry, things like immigration, population, innovation, automation, mechanization, hybridization, globalization or deglobalization, regulation, inflation, and the future and security of our nation. Those are the things I'm going to be talking about when I'm with your organization, Kyle and Dave. And if you have a meeting coming up in 2023, trust me, there's no space in January and February, but we might have something come April and May. Give us a call. Let me know if I can help. Thanks for being here, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
You shed some light on some things that a lot of people didn't know. And, I'd say we only disagreed on about three topics, so that's not bad.
Look forward to February.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Until next time, this is the business. Oh, by the way, if you want to learn more about what they can offer you, how do they find you? Kyle, how do they find you?
StoneX.com.
StoneX.com. Go and check it out. And by the way, one of their awesome employees is a guy named Ryan Moe. He's part of my Business of Ag Success group, and he's a kick. So if you don't like what these guys say, you should find out how to get on Ryan's daily newsletter, which is it's entertainment, if nothing else, but it's also very informative. Till next time, I'm Damian Mason. Thanks for being here, guys, from StoneX.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's the Business of Agriculture. Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right, Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag, that's www.pattern.ag, to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.